Hey, this is Maya, and you're listening to the Brad Gilmore Show.
Oh, Brad, what have you done now?
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Brad Gilmore Show. Oh, Dumen. It's good to be back here on the show. It's so many things have been going on in my life over the last several weeks, months, years. But it's exciting to be back. I'm going to be back more frequently here, updating you and all things going on with me, man. I literally have had such a whirlwind couple of weeks. 2 weeks ago, 2 weekends ago, I had all the guys in here from the movie Trivia Schmodown. We did a live event at the World Gym Arena in Houston, Texas, or in Tex City, Texas. You know, that's my home court where Booker T and I are always at. And it was a phenomenal event, sold out event, not an open seat anywhere. I guess that's what sold out means. So I did that. Long weekend. A lot of the guys got in on Thursday. None of them are from Houston. I'm the only Houston, Texas native. So I had to go out and, you know, I had to be the host. I had to be the host for everybody in Houston. I had to show them where to eat, do this, do that, you know, do whatever. Just be the go-to guy. So that was a lot. It was like Thursday to Sunday, running around doing stuff. And then last weekend, Booker T and I were out in Las Vegas, Nevada for StarCast, which you can actually hear that podcast that we did, live podcast at Caesar's Palace. You can hear that on our podcast, The Hall of Fame. Go to the hallofamepodcast.com or your favorite podcast app. Type Hall of Fame in. You'll see Booker T and Brad Gilmore, Hall of Fame on ESPN. And we do that 3 days a week, by the way. But you can hear that full show over there. But, you know, StarCast was so cool, man. I, you know, got to the building. I got in Vegas at like 11:15 p.m. Went straight from the airport, McCarran Airport, went all the way down to the Strip to Planet Hollywood, got in Planet Hollywood, checked in at probably about midnight, showered, did what I needed to do, go to bed, and had to wake up, you know, at like 7 a.m., get ready, get dressed, go over to Caesar's Palace, get ready for the show. So I woke up, went right over there, got there about 30 minutes before showtime, haven't spoken to Booker at all. It's 10 minutes till. And Tony Schiavone comes and grabs me. He says, "Hey, Brad, we got to go over your rundown." So I go over the rundown of the show with Tony Schiavone, just meaning time. So he's like, "All right, you're going to go on at, you know, 9 or 10 o'clock. And then from 10 to 10, it's on you. And then you can bring up Booker. And then you and Booker go to, you know, whatever. And then we'll bring up Scott Hall, Kevin Nash. They were our scheduled guests. They didn't make it. It's Las Vegas, brother. And then we'll get you off." So Schiavone says that. Booker and I are walking through the backstage area to get to the gorilla position to walk out to the stage. And I was like, "Hey, Book, what do you want to talk about?" He's like, "I don't know. You know, maybe we talk about Double or Nothing or something like that." I'm like, "All right, cool. We'll figure it out there." And then we went out there without a single thing written down, nothing planned. And we did an hour and a half without stopping. And it was a great show. So go check that out over on our podcast feed. And then literally I left the show, got back on the airplane, or, you know, got in a taxi, went straight to the airport, was on a plane by 1 p.m., and I was out of Vegas. So I was in Vegas less than 24 hours. I was in Vegas probably like 8 or 9 hours, and then I split. But I watched Double or Nothing on the plane, which was phenomenal. You can hear Booker and I's thoughts on Double or Nothing on our YouTube channel, youtube.com, Reality of Wrestling, I believe is the slash. But just find our channel, Reality of Wrestling, hit subscribe. And, you know, watch Double or Nothing on the plane. Was so happy to see Kylie Rae, who is a Reality Wrestling original, and so many things like that. But anyway, I tell this to say I've been busy. We got a show with the Dynamo tomorrow, which is the soccer team in Houston. After I do this podcast, I got to go do the Schmodown podcast again, the Schmodown rundown. So I'm all over the place. But I have some good stuff lined up for the next couple weeks, like today's show. Today's show, I got Tommy Avalone on. Tommy was the director of the Bill Murray Stories, which is this documentary I watched on the plane going to WrestleMania last month. And it's a documentary talking about all these Bill Murray stories, which we've always heard. I've always heard that, you know, Bill Murray was driving a taxi and he was picking up fares and said that nobody will ever believe you and stuff like that. And Tommy did a documentary about these stories, trying to find their validity. Did they really happen? Did they really occur? And maybe we can even hear from the man himself, Bill Murray, in this documentary. Do we hear from him? I don't know. You're going to have to find out. But I watched this documentary on the plane, DM Tommy. I said, "Hey, let's do a podcast together." So this is that show. This is that show. So check it out. This is myself and Tommy Avalone, the director of the Bill Murray Stories.
Oh, Brad, what have you done now?
And he joins me on the show right now, the director of the Bill Murray Stories, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Mr. Tommy Avalone is here with us. Tommy, how you doing?
Hey, man, how are you?
I am great. I'm glad that we finally got to do this. I have so much to ask you about, first of all, the Bill Murray Stories, which was fantastic. I loved the film. I watched it on the plane. We're going to get into it in a second. But you've been quite the busy individual. I know that you were just at the Tribeca Film Festival. You're a producer, director. You did I Am Santa Claus, Ghost Heads you were a producer in. You have a new movie coming out soon, Waldo on Weed, which we'll talk about as well. But let's jump into it, because here's how this happened. I host a show with Hall of Famer Booker T, and Booker
two-time
T.
Two-time Hall of Famer.
Thank you for the correction. And Booker, when I got the call, that he called me and he said, hey, I'm going in the Hall of Fame again for WrestleMania weekend. I said, okay, I'm going to be there. I got to be there. So I booked my ticket to go to New York, New Jersey area where WrestleMania was going to be. The Barclays Center was home for the Hall of Fame this year, so I was excited to go. So I'm on the plane, United plane. I got my little iPad out. I'm ready. I'm sitting in. I'm comfortable. I'm strapped in. They gave me one of those little wafer snacks that I absolutely hate, but I was like, all right, whatever. I'm going to get some sugar in me. I'm going to be ready. When I land, I got to go. So I'm looking on their United app, trying to find a movie to watch, and I see your film, The Bill Murray Stories. I said, oh, man, I've heard about this. A friend of mine at Reality Wrestling had told me about the documentary maybe a few months before. I knew it was out there, and I was like, man, I got to see this thing. I love Bill Murray. And I, much like so many people out there, have always heard the legends of the Bill Murray Stories, and I kind of spread some of the legend as well. I would hear the story, and then if Bill Murray came up in conversation, I'd say, hey, did you ever hear about the time that he showed up at somebody's wedding, and, he married them and said no one will ever believe you? Everybody had heard these stories. So I watched the documentary, absolutely fall in love with it. I loved the narrative of it. I loved how you recreated some of these moments. So then I had to reach out to you. Now you're on the show. So first off, the film was incredible. What has been the feedback that you've gotten from people about the Bill Murray Stories?
Yeah, I mean, we had quite a run. We premiered at South by Southwest in March of 2018, sold out all our screenings there. We went to Hot Docs in Toronto, sold all our screenings out there. Did a great run at the BFI in London, sold out all our screenings there. So we did like this amazing like festival run. Then we hit iTunes and we were number one documentary on iTunes for an hour,
Hey, in today's world, that's a lot, because the trending topic changes every 5 minutes. So to be up there for an hour is pretty incredible.
Yeah, I was stoked. And then we hit Netflix. I mean, look, I've had movies on Netflix before, but never it hit like this. Like, people were just, I guess, ready to watch a movie about Bill Murray Stories. And the great thing is, it's like, I like to think that we make these sort of Trojan horse movies where you walk in with one thing, but you kind of leave with this like hidden message. And it resonated with a lot of people where it just like helped them with their day, or they're going through something and it kind of like helped them out. So like, that to me is like what I'm kind of most stoked about, is like the way people connected to the message.
And I think it's an easy message. I mean, everybody loves Bill Murray. I think he's one of the few people who is universally loved. I've never met anybody, maybe except for Chevy Chase, who didn't enjoy being around Bill Murray. And I think that was one of the things that intrigued me. And I was just like, how will Tommy in this film, how will he be able to tell these stories and find out any validity to them? Because to me, it's like, how are you going to track any of these things down? How are you going to start? What are the forensics here? And then when you did it, and in the film, you find the people who were the originators of these stories, or a lot of them. How did you do that? How did you track these folks down to try to see if Bill Murray really was, a roadie for a female punk rock band? Or, how did you find these people?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, to the first part of your question is, like, our approach to this was, we were making a Bigfoot documentary, Bill Murray wasn't Bigfoot, but the stories were Bigfoot. So we wanted to kind of, like, have that sense of mystery and, like, detective novel meets Bigfoot documentary. So we kind of wanted that sort of feeling, keeping the mystery alive. I mean, even with our last movie, I Am Santa Claus, you're kind of saying, hey, Santa's not real, but look how great it is for the people who keep it real, So you're kind of like still keeping the love and the mystery alive. But to reach out to these people who've had these stories, a lot of times their names written about in like the Chive or, Esquire or some of the magazines that will have written about these things. And then you thank God for Facebook, because, you know, these people who had these stories don't have managers or agents or PR people, you know, they just have Facebook accounts. So back then, this is about like 2011, 2012. No, wait, that's not true. 2015, 2016. You couldn't just send someone on Facebook a message that you weren't friends with, you know, or else it would go to their other folder, in which no one ever knew the other folder existed.
Nobody knows that today, but continue.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I had to go, and some particular people, like especially the, like Margaret from the girls, of the kickball game, you know, I had to go through her friends and find someone that would accept me, you know, like it's usually like a band, a comedian, like an actor, someone who just accepts anyone, you
right.
know? So I would do that. And once I got that sort of thing, I had a mutual friend, and then I was able to send them a message. So it was a lot of kind of like detective work in some sense to get some of these people, you know, just to talk to me.
Yeah. I mean, it really was like trying to track down Bigfoot and so, okay. So let's talk about this, because the film starts off, I believe it's, you know, three friends sitting at a diner or sitting at a restaurant somewhere, and they're discussing. The first thing that jumped out to me when I'm watching the opening scene, first thing, and I'm sure you already know what it is, the Cactus Jack t-shirt. It was the first thing that popped out to me. It was the first thing, and I was like, oh, this guy's got some flavor. And then, you know, when I looked you up, you know, I Am Santa Claus, which of course Mick Foley was heavily involved in. Talk to me a little bit about wrestling before we get back to Bill Murray. I mean, because the only reason I even came across the documentary was someone at my wrestling promotion told me about it, and then I'm on the way to WrestleMania and I see it. So wrestling, for some reason, was brought me to this movie. It was like a destiny. But tell me about the love of wrestling. Why was it important to include that and work with Mick and all that?
Well, I'm a huge, huge wrestling fan. You know, like my grandfather got me into it. My first WrestleMania that I saw was WrestleMania 9. It was,
interesting.
You know, Hulk
Hogan.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, for some reason, people make fun of me about that. I did X-Pac show, and he's like, that's the worst WrestleMania. It's like, no, it was a good one. Yokozuna, Hulk Hogan, Bret Hart.
Yeah. Whatever. Jim Ross in a toga. Like, what can you not like?
Yeah. Doink versus Doink on the Crush. Come on.
Taker and Giant Gonzalez. Doink. Classic.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. Of course. So, anyway, so I just a huge, huge wrestling fan since, like, like a child. And, you know, every one of our movies, we try to put a professional wrestler in. The scripted movies that I was producing at the time were super easy. We would like Blue Meanie, Jim the Anvil Neidhart, Tommy Dreamer, Al Snow. But, you know, once you get into the documentary world, it's kind of harder to do that, because if it doesn't organically fit, then you're not really making a true documentary, you know? But the great thing is when we were doing I Am Santa Claus, we found out that Mick was like a huge, huge Santa Claus mark, you know, and it was our organic way of putting him in there, where he would be actually portraying Santa for the first time, bleaching his beard, you know, and actually going to one of his favorite Santa stops and being Santa. And then so we were able to have Roddy Piper in our movie, Jerry the King Lawler, Tommy Dreamer, and Blue Meanie were back in it. So we always do try to put wrestlers in it. Even Ghostheads, we interviewed Zack Ryder.
Yeah.
For Bill Murray, we interviewed George the Animal Steele. Unfortunately, we had to cut it. But there's always going to be wrestling in some way. Like, I mean, Kevin Smith, we used to put like Jaws and Star Wars stuff in his movies. And I try to do those little Easter eggs, because to me, as a fan of movies, I love that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so you're putting it into your own art. I completely resonate with that. So wait, George Animal Steele's on the cutting room floor. What was his Bill Murray interaction?
Well, so when we first started doing the movie, like he was one of the early, early interviews. Like we were trying to like talk to his people that were in movies with him. He was in Ed Wood with Bill mm-hmm. Murray. So we were kind of just like talking to him, like, what was it like working with Bill and all sort of stuff? So it was just like in the beginning stage, it didn't work. But it's on the DVD. Like we have like – this like fantastic interview with him talking about Bill and how much Bill mean to him. It just didn't work in the what was the end narrative, you know?
Okay. Well, I got to get the DVD. I got to see that interview. I only watched it on streaming. So now I got to see what George Animal Steele said. Did he have the green tongue?
Just to plug the DVD real quick, or Blu-ray, you know, great extra interviews with Joel Murray, the brother, and Peter Farrelly. You know, a lot of stuff just about Bill Murray, the actor, not so much Bill Murray, the, you know, Bigfoot.
So everyone get that. Is it available on Amazon, I'm assuming? Amazon.com, yeah. Maybe you can get it? Okay. Yeah. But when I'm watching it, there were a couple of them that I was just for sure thought were fake. Like, I didn't think that Bill Murray, when it was first floated in the film, I didn't think that he actually read poetry to a group of construction workers. Because to me, out of all of them, even being a roadie for, you know, a band, or being a bartender, or posing in somebody's wedding photos, or playing a pickup kickball game, out of all of those, or even washing somebody's dishes, to me,
the one I thought was fake.
That one actually did sound fake too. But I think that the top two were the washing of the dishes and the reading the poetry to construction workers. I think the randomness of the poetry, mm-hmm. when it's not in context, when you see the film, and I don't really want to give away too much because I want people to go out and watch it, but when you see the film and the story is then put in context, it made more sense. But when you just see the kind of the reenactment that you did, which, by the way, the reenactments were so great. I loved of them. And I know probably at sometimes you thought maybe this is a risk having this strange looking Bigfootish Bill Murray in some of the shots, but I loved it. I love those recreations. Oh, cool. It brought a sense of realism to it. But when you see the recreation of, you know, the construction workers and the poetry, I'm like, there's no way. And then I think that's also the thing about the film is, okay, when you put Bill Murray in these situations, it sounds unusual, it sounds impossible, but at the end of the day, what I really loved about the film was Bill Murray's just a guy. He's just a guy. Yeah. He's just a guy whose name you happen to recognize. But if I heard that my neighbor next door, you know, went down to read poetry to a construction worker, I probably wouldn't think it was that strange. But just the fact that it was Bill Murray, I mean, it'd be a little weird, but the fact that it's Bill Murray is really what sticks out. And I think that's kind of what you got across in the documentary, that Bill's just, he's just a regular guy.
Yeah, like Peter Farrelly, who since went to win the Academy Award.
Yeah,
Green Book. He said it pretty great. He was like, you know, it's not, Bill's not performing for these people. He's just Bill, and he's at your party, and that's part of the joke. You know, he's just watching TV with you. You know, and that's what makes it so special. Like, he's the most normal famous guy in the world. Normal in that, like, he's not adding into the fame. You know, like, he's not doing, like, he doesn't have a manager, he doesn't have an agent, he doesn't have a PR person, he just has a 1-800 number, and that's it, you know?
Yes, and okay. Let's talk about that scene for a second, because throughout the movie, you try to contact the legendary 1-800 number. And yeah. I had heard about this number before. You know, I knew that he just had a phone, and that's the only way you can reach him. You actually had Mark Malkov in the documentary, who's been on my show before. He hosts the Great Carson podcast, which I love.
Yeah.
And, you know, he and I actually spoke about it, but way before this, like maybe like a couple years ago, about the phone number. Mm-hmm. You make several attempts to call and leave the message. Were those, as we say in wrestling, were those a shoot? Were you turning up for the camera? Was it a little bit of a work shoot there, or was that like genuine nerves? Like, okay, what do I say to Bill Murray?
You know, you're talking to nothing. You know,
right.
You're talking to an answer machine. You know, that you can delete and start again and all that sort of stuff. And that alone, I guess it's the fact that like you can delete it and start again. Like, so there's an element of trying to make it somewhat perfect. That's so intimidating. To me, it felt like that scene in Swingers where he was like trying to leave a message on a girl's answer machine. But like, yeah, no, that's legit. Those weren't the messages that were on his thing. Like the messages I didn't put in the movie because they were just more serious. But that was legit, like me being like neurotic and weird and nervous about calling, you know, this Ghostbuster.
Right. I mean, and I guess. Did the myth of Bill Murray build up bigger in your head than maybe most people? Because you did the Ghost Heads documentary, which is on Netflix too, I believe. I watched it maybe about a month ago. It was on Netflix. And really fun. And I love the Ghostbusters too. But was it the fact that you had worked on this project, you know, Ghost Heads, obviously you're a big Ghostbusters fan. Is that what built up Bill Murray to even a bigger icon to you than maybe he is to some people? Because he's huge to everybody, but to me it felt like you had a real personal connection to Bill Murray.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm a huge Ghostbusters fan, you know. We actually started doing the Bill Murray stories before Ghostheads. You know, it was a weird situation where we we filmed the kickball, we filmed the karaoke, and we filmed a couple other people. And then we started interviewing Ghostbuster fans to get their take on Bill Murray. And that's how we kind of like found this project that was already happening called Ghost Heads. So that's when I came on as a producer and editor for that particular movie. So it was just really organic how they kind of all came together. But yeah, I'm a huge, huge Ghostbusters fan, huge Bill Murray fan. But I guess what made him more special to me is the fact that I did all this research on him and I knew so much about him. You know, like, you know, having read many books, many articles, talked to many different people, like Bill Murray's on my whiteboard for like 3 years. Like, it's just like it becomes a thing that you are just focused on. And so, yeah, it was a little bit more important maybe than most. But like when you see Bill, like whether you're doing that research or not, like he just stands out and makes you feel like there's someone special in the room. It's very unique. And I've been around like famous people and stuff. And you sometimes you get that feeling, but Bill, you know, I think that was a times a little bit more.
Yeah, no. And I felt that now at the beginning of the film. Also, you show this picture of you and Bill Murray, and then you kind of tell the story about the buildup to the picture. And kind of your goal for the film was not only trying to prove the myth of the Bill Murray Bigfoot, but hunting down the man himself and then kind of not confronting him, but, you know, inquiring about some of these tales to him directly, have him a part of the project. And by the end of the movie, though, you kind of say, you know what, I just wanted my own Bill Murray story. I didn't need him to be in the film and tell all these stories or confirm or deny them. I just wanted my own Bill Murray story. Why did you make that choice?
Well, it kind of. You know, I mean, it's like we put that picture in the beginning of me and Bill to rip it off like a Band-Aid. You know, I didn't want this movie to be, will he get Bill Murray? You know, like there's movies out there that do well, like My Date with Drew, or these different situations where someone is out to, you know, searching for Sugar Man or whatever it might be, you know? And I didn't want that. I didn't want this to be like a will he get Bill Murray, because that was not my goal. You know, my goal was to tell these interesting stories of him doing these things and try to figure out why, you know. And even when calling Bill, like I didn't want to sit down with him and be like, so if we're making a Bigfoot documentary, right? Like you're not going to sit down at the end with Bigfoot and go, so what's with the woods? What are you doing? You know, it just destroys that magic, you know?
Yeah.
So like when we were talking to him, we were just trying to I was just trying to talk to him about, like, you know, maybe interesting ways in which we can involve him in the movie sort of thing. And, you know, it didn't work out that way. And I'm glad it didn't, because the way, you know, being in his space and, you know, not and then kind of like planning this situation and not being present or just ending, you know, it just felt too set up. And it wasn't really a part of the Bill Murray fun that Bill Murray does these things, you know. So and I wasn't like the documentary that, you know, puts himself documentarian that puts himself in and goes, my name is Tommy Avalone and I'm going to have a Bill Murray story. You know, like that's not
right.
That was not what we wanted to do. You know, I never even talked to camera, you know, like I've seen plenty of documentaries where the people will put themselves in there and it's just to kind of put themselves over. And that was not really what we wanted to do, but we knew like putting myself in there was a way to kind of thread together some of these stories so they wouldn't look and feel like vignettes, you know? So the conclusion in my movie is such a like an organic way, because, you know, you're around Bill, you're in Bill's presence, you know, and you try to, and you know, someone told me a long time ago, what's important to you is sometimes not important to someone else. You know, it's important to me to make this movie, but Bill Murray doesn't care if I make this movie, you know, Bill's just exists. He wants to watch the game, you know? So there's a lot of these sort of elements and emotions going on. And the conclusion we come to was like an organic way. We, you know, kind of just figuring that out in the car ride home. You know, we're like, we just, it felt very uncomfortable, like trying to force our way into this. And we just didn't want to do that.
And I understand that. I get that too. But I am glad that you were in the film, because I felt that we were experiencing all these things and tracking all these things down with you. It was a Bigfoot documentary, but it was also a detective story. It really was. And I felt like, you know, like this was Fletch and I'm a part of the mission. I'm a part of the mission as much as I am a viewer of the story. And I think that it was really important that you were in it. So I'm glad that you were. And that was a great, it was a great choice. So
yeah, we used like a comparison of like, Tickled, you know, like whereas like the director of that movie, you know, he's a detective, he's a journalist really. So like, I was like, oh, well that's what my role is. I'm not personality or director, I'm the journalist, you know?
Yeah, no, and that came across that way. It really did. And, cool, and I think cool, that was you. Another thing that kind of resonated because we were living it through you, too. You know what I mean? We were yeah. trying to figure it out through you. The crazy thing, though, to me was the washing of the dishes story, the one that you said that there's no way this is true. It right. it happened in – was it in London?
So the guy who we talked to lives in Brighton, like 2 hours outside of London, but it happened in St. Andrews in Scotland.
In Scotland. Okay. Okay. So you flew all the way to the UK to experience this. What did, now, did you get to visit the actual house or did you just track down the guy and say, you know what, we're just going to shoot this on location? Because I think it'd been easy for most people to say, oh, I'll get him on Skype or I'll, you know, try to just do a phone call and I'll Ken Burns it up a little bit with some still photographs. But you flew all the way over there. I mean, to me, that in my opinion, I was like, wow, he's really going the extra mile to make sure we get the full experience of these stories.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing. Like, we thought about, like, oh, we could just hire someone with a camera and I could just ask the questions via whatever, you know? But I was like, what's the Bill Murray in that? You know, there's no experience in that, you know? And I've never been to Europe, you know? So I was like, I think I'm going to go, you know? Like, so we just did everything. We did, you know, even, you know, going to London and Brighton and St. Andrews and all these things was awesome. Like, we went down Hope Street, which is where the house was. Like, this was years ago. This was probably in 2010, maybe when it happened. So there's no way that person lives there anymore. It's a college town, you know?
Right.
So there was a lot of just kind of going back and doing all this sort of things, talking to him, and just experiencing London, eating haggis, you know, doing the Beatles street, you know? That
Abbey Road.
You know, Abbey Road, yeah. So I was just experiencing all that sort of stuff. It's the same thing Bill does when he's shooting a movie and happens to be near, like, a river. He's like, you know, forget the scene. Let's go down the river, you know? Like, and you just want to kind of have these experiences, you know?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I'm going to – Booker and I are doing a tour of the UK in July. I don't know if I'm looking forward to haggis, but maybe I'll go down Abbey Road. I don't know. I'm a little afraid of the food over there. Was the food okay? Because a lot of people have built
great.
It up. It was great. Okay. That makes me feel better.
Yeah.
That makes me feel better.
I think I had rabbit when I was in London.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, I'm just a dope when it comes to the conversion rates, you know. So that was the hardest thing for me. But yeah, when we were in Scotland, we had the haggis, and I enjoyed it. You know, I'm from the Philadelphia area, so it's like scrapple in some sense. So
okay, well that makes a little bit more sense. I'm from Texas, so you know, if it's anything like barbecue, maybe I can get into it. but okay, so the movie comes out, a lot of great feedback. You say you sell out the screenings at South by Southwest, all these great things.
Yeah.
Do you know if Bigfoot himself, Bill Murray, I'm sure he's aware of the film. Do you know if he's seen it? Have you heard anything about it from him?
Yeah. So Joel Murray, who's in our movie, who's mm-hmm. Bill Murray's brother, he's seen it and loved it and said it was fantastic. And to me, that's all I need, you know? And it's kind of like when we made Ghost Heads, it's like, or even Santa, like I didn't make it for the Santa's or the Ghost Heads. I made it for like, you know, Universal sort of tale. So if Bill sees it, that's awesome. But he was on the Today Show, and I asked him. They even had a picture of me and Bill up on the screen, which was just super awesome. And they go, "He's Bill Murray stories. You know, there's actually a documentary about him." He goes, "Yeah, you know, I'm aware of it." And they asked me to be in it, but a movie about myself. That's something I'll be in when I pass away. So like he's aware of it. I don't think he'll ever see it, and if he has or does, I won't know about it. But I'm cool with that. Like it's just. You know, here's what I had. I joked about when we would do the Q&As. It's like the Hollywood – the way this story ends in Hollywood is we're doing a screening. Everyone's like applauding at the end. I'm up on stage and I can see Bill Murray in the back clapping. He gives me a thumbs up. No one else can see him. And he just turns around and disappears. And that's it. That's the way this ends in the Hollywood scripted version of this.
yeah, I would like that. That'd be nice. Yeah, that'd be a nice bow on it. Really, guys, if y'all haven't seen this documentary, you got to go out and watch it. Even if you're not a Bill Murray fan, everyone has heard the Bill Murray story. And it's so funny because honestly, Tommy, I had never watched anything on YouTube about the stories. I'd never read anything about the stories. I had just heard them, you know, via somebody told me this thing about Bill Murray that they heard. Right. And it's so funny. And I'm sure you found this a lot because in the documentary, when I think it was at a Comic-Con or something like that, when the fan asked him, you know, there's all these stories about you and they all end with no one will ever believe you. That's what the story, I don't understand how everybody had this collective conscious, because that's how I always ended the stories that I would tell about Bill Murray. He turns around and says, no one will ever believe you. I don't know, did you ever figure out the genesis of that? Because I just find it so crazy that everybody had the same ending line.
Well, I think it's a little bit of whispered down the line, you know, like I think there is, at one point he did do that, maybe for a couple of years he might have said that to a couple different people, but I think it made into its own thing. Like, having been around, you know, just doing the press of it all, or just people talking after the movie, or just talking while we're making the movie, a lot of people tell the stories wrong. You know, like there's this, like, oh, he was at a wedding and he jumped in someone's wedding photo. Oh, it's not his engagement photo. It's like all these like small details. And you know, we were actually going to put a part of the movie where people just told these stories wrong. And I think that's what's even more special about it, is because they become this folklore. They become this, you know, something that's not real, but based on some sort of reality, you know? And even so much the Bill Murray slow motion video, like that to me was, the way I heard about it was, someone went up to Bill and was like, can I get an autograph? He's like, no, let's not do an autograph. Let's just walk down this hallway in slow motion instead. And it was kind of like that, but it wasn't, you know, like talking to the real people. They're like, no, it was like this, you know? So I think at some point, and there was like some golfer that apparently went up to him. I was like, do you really do that? And he said, yes, you know, but who knows, you know? And it's one of those things that you're making a documentary, you want things to be truthful, but you know, it's a Bill Murray story. You know, there's some answers you don't want answered, you know?
Yeah.
Some questions you don't want answered, rather.
No, 100%. And God, yeah. it was such a great film, such a great watch. I enjoyed it so much. The Bill Murray stories on Netflix, and you can, you know, buy the DVD on Amazon, which I'm going to do after the end of this, because I got to see that George Animal Steel conversation.
Thank you.
But you have another film that you're working on right now, or you just debuted at the Tribeca Film Festival. We were talking about it a little bit before, but Waldo on Weed. Tell me, what is this movie about?
Yeah, it's executive produced by Whoopi Goldberg. We just premiered at Tribeca. It's a little bit more serious. It's my friend from Philadelphia. His son had eye cancer at 6 months old. And they started using cannabis oil to counteract the results of his chemotherapy. And he filmed, the father, Brian, he filmed this whole thing on a flip camera, which he entitled Dad Cam. So there's this like very – sorry, I'm like coming off of a cold.
Are you all good?
There's this like living in the moment, or capturing things in the moment sort of aspect to the film, where, you know, Brian and Danielle, the parents of Waldo, are going through this experience of having their son have cancer. And using this, and illegally, you know, getting this, 2014 when this happened, illegally getting this cannabis oil to kind of help his son. So it's a really interesting movie. It's just different than anything I've ever done. But so that's the movie. And then it premiered at Tribeca, and it was great. It was cool having, like, doing the red carpet. Whoopi Goldberg was there. It was fun. Waldo was there. Waldo's good. So, yeah.
That's awesome, man. So that's coming out soon. We'll keep a lookout for that. Let's talk a little bit of wrestling, if you don't mind.
Okay.
You're a filmmaker, you know, you writer, you're a creative type. A lot of complaints right now about the WWE product. Do you feel that way too?
Yeah, I don't like to complain publicly.
Yeah, I don't either. And you know what? I appreciate that, because here's the thing, is if I'm a fan of something, I'm going to be a fan of it. Like, I'm in Houston. My Houston Rockets, they just lost to the Golden State Warriors for like the 18th millionth time this past week. They're still my favorite team. I'm still going to root for the Rockets. A winning season, a losing season, they're going through a rough patch. If they're on top of the world, they're still my team. You know, Bill Murray, let's go to him. He's going to make some great movies. He's going to make some not so great movies. I'm a Bill Murray fan. I'm going to watch them. And I'm still going to be a fan whether I like the movie or not, because I like the guy. I've always been a fan. And that's what kind of gets me sometimes about, you know, some of the wrestling community. It's a vocal minority, I feel. But a lot of times people like to complain about it. I mean, just what's your take on that?
Well, I mean, look, I mean, I love what they're doing with Becky Lynch right now. I think Becky Two Belts is fantastic. I hope she keeps them over this weekend. Loving the Kofi Kingston stuff. I hope Big E comes back soon. I don't know how long he's out for. I love Kevin Owens is back as a heel. I love oh god, why am I blanking on his name? The redheaded guy from
Sami Zayn.
Yeah, I love how he's like just speaking to all the smarks, you know? Like I love that. I think there's some good stuff. I mean, you're always gonna have some things that are kinda like dopey, you know, but like but yeah, I mean it can't all be perfect. And I mean, God, I can't imagine 3 hours and one show, 2 hours and the other every week, you know, it's like I enjoy watching it.
Yeah, I'm in the boat with you. Okay, let's talk about who's on your Mount Rushmore of pro wrestlers.
Oh man, that's such a tough question. Someone was asking that the other day. So it's gonna be four spots, right?
Right.
Yeah, so like I'm not sure if this is a popular opinion, but I was never like an Andre sort of guy, you know, like to me, it was Hogan, you know?
Absolutely.
You know, and, you know, I guess it's, you know, you want to have like a generational thing. So it's The Rock and Stone Cold. And, you know, I'll put Foley in there because I mean, Foley kind of helped change a lot of stuff.
Well, yeah. What do you think that Mick Foley changed the most about pro wrestling?
I mean, just that, I mean, he kind of helped with that style, especially during the 90s, you know, everything was so hardcore during the Attitude Era, and he was really kind of one of the beginning guys that, I guess, him and Terry Funk, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that, you know, especially in the WWE back then, WWF, to have a guy who looked like Mick Foley, who definitely wasn't someone you would think would be on the cover of Muscle and Fitness or anything like that, but to have somebody like that be your WWE champion at the height of your popularity, I think that that said something about Mick Foley, the performer and the character, and also what he brought, you know, in a sense of realism and emotion to the ring, because, you know, that's not
a storyteller. Exactly. You know? I mean, he would come over our house, my house sometimes, and help us edit the Santa Claus movie, you know, and like, we would talk in wrestling terms. It's like, oh, this is the heel turn, you know, or like, when like, he would like, you cut right here. And I'd be like, well, why? And he's like, well, he's like, this is your going home moment right here, you know? But like, you know, he gets to a point a little bit down the line, but if we go home right here, then it leaves you wanting more. And like, he just knows how to tell a story. And like, you know, I mean, I was just watching something about Hulk Hogan where they're like, oh, he wasn't a great worker, but man, could he perform? And that's what I liked about wrestling. You know, there's really not saying this about Mick, but like, you know, I love the performance of it, you know, like like, there's some amazing wrestlers like Daniel Bryan and all that sort of stuff right now, and I do like them, you know, but I love the mic. You know, I love the CM Punks and all that sort of stuff with that sort of thing. And I, you know, I just think the way people can tell a story or sell the tickets by just, you know, talking on the mic.
And being a character, man, and performing from a storytelling perspective, you know, working with Booker for the last 7 years almost, that's the thing that I learned most from him was, you know, it's not about the move that you do. It's about what you do before the move and after the move and why are you doing the move. And to me, that's what makes wrestling so good. And I think a lot of it's funny. I feel like a lot of creatives, especially in the space of, you know, movies, television, documentaries, at least in my conversations, and maybe we just all hang around with the same people, a lot of them have an affinity for pro wrestling. And I think it is that storytelling perspective, because I don't think there's anything like pro wrestling where you're a live show on television, but you're also in front of a live crowd. It's athletic exhibition, but also a soap opera. And you only have one take to do it. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many factors involved in it that make it, to me, you know, one of the greater forms of just fun entertainment that there is out there. So it's always fun to talk to another pro wrestling fan. But that's interesting. That's an interesting Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, I mean, like, to me, like, it's just so funny because, like, wrestling is good and bad all at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, it's like you know, if you're sitting there watching it with a buddy who's a pro wrestling fan, it's amazing. But if you're there watching someone who's like maybe not a fan or on the fence, it just looks so corny and it's always like silly, you know, but like, you know, you kind of have to like just be there to love it and appreciate it. And then it happens, you know, then it becomes good, you know, like, I mean, this last WrestleMania, like I was just tearing up when Kofi won, you know, it's like, it's just, and I really like, not that I wasn't a Kofi fan, but like he never stood out to me, you know, like, but the way they built that, like, I don't know, what, 2 month run to like this, you know, in that moment, you know, you're like, it has been 11 years. He hasn't ever had a chance, you know, and then for it to happen, his kids are there. You're like, this is so great. you know,
and absolutely. Like, and how much, you know, it meant to you know, the Black community, the African-American community, to never have representation, or they felt they had never had representation, especially in the WWE championship picture. I was sitting next to Queen Charmel, Booker's wife, at the time. We were sitting in WrestleMania watching it. And, you know, when Kofi won, you know, she just turned around to me, hugged me as tight as she could, and started crying. You know, it was a real emotional moment. And it meant a lot to a lot of people, me included, and obviously you included. But that, those are the moments that you look for. And then when you take a non-wrestling fan, you say, look at this, though. Look at this. You see this moment? This is so great, right? Or I always point people, if you're not a wrestling fan, go watch Booker T and Stone Cold Steve Austin in the grocery store. And I guarantee you're going to be like, that was some of the most entertaining stuff I've ever watched in my life. I laughed,
like,
and everything.
Like on paper, maybe King Booker's not a great idea, but the performance is the best thing in the world. Like, the fact that he changed his dialect, like, he had a British accent, you know, and King Booker, like, that is professional wrestling. That is just putting 110% in and just making something silly over, you know, like, you know, it's I think a lot of people frown on it now, but the what, you know, like, that was at the time amazing. I mean, the fans ruin it, much like fans ruin everything, but, like, you know, but it's good stuff.
The what chant, I feel, has really become, you know, the last Jedi of the pro wrestling world. Is like, some people love the chant, some people hate it. Some of the boys love it, some of them hate it. But I think that it, when what first happened, I think it was great. And the fact that you can, like, that's the guys who are really great, Steve Austin's, the Booker T's, the Chris Jericho's, the Triple H's, the Rock's, the whomever's, right? They're, if you can get a singular word over, like, what? Or if you can get, like, Jericho in his last run, he got it over, IT, he got it over. Those are the guys that you have to look to and say, wow, they belong in the conversation for the greatest of all time. Not because of what they did in the ring, what they did on the mic and how they were able to connect with the crowd. You got it and what over. Like, just two words. Booker got good over. He just puts a T at the end of it and says good, and everyone loves it. You know what I mean? So it's just, well, it's so funny.
Doesn't he have the quacky quack,
Chucky
quack,
Ducky quack quack? Yeah.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
You know, when we do radio together, Booker's wearing now a rubber duck necklace that lights up. And it's one of my favorite things in the world. I'll send you a picture of it. It's absolutely hilarious. But Waldo on Wii, we know, is coming soon. I Am Santa Claus and the Bill Murray stories are available, as well as Ghost Heads. I would really recommend Ghost Heads.
Really?
Yes.
That's the one? That's my least favorite.
No. Oh, no. I mean, I'm saying I recommend them all, obviously. But I really love Ghost Heads because – so I'm a huge Back to the Future mark. And for some reason, I have crossover with the Ghost Heads. Ghostbuster fans and Back to the Future fans, I feel like we understand one another. And Zack Ryder is a big Back to the Future and Ghostbusters fan.
And
he's a big theme park fan, which I am too. I don't understand this weird world that we inhabit. But I really liked the film, and I didn't know that everyone, you know, in the movie, guys, there's like, I don't know, every city has their own Ghostbusters unit, which I found interesting. I didn't know any of this. So I if you're a Ghostbusters fan, I really do recommend going out and checking it out. It's like, I think 58 minutes, 60 minutes. I'm like, it's not super long, right?
It's like 74. I mean, the thing about the movie is, like, you know, you don't have to like Ghostbusters. It's just interesting to see, like, here's this movie that was made 30 some odd years ago, and what it's done to the people who grew up watching it. And, you know, there's certain people who stopped drinking and they were an alcoholic, stopped drinking because of Ghostbusters. There's certain people who have come from broken homes and their mom and dad weren't talking to each other. But, you know, when he was visiting his grandfather, they would put on Ghostbusters. It was a way for him to communicate that way. Like, it's to me, like, and we talked to psychologists in it as well. Like, what I do like about the movie is, like, it is one of those situations that uses Ghostbusters as trying to see what holes in your heart you're feeling in that, and why we fill it with that sort of stuff. And, you know, there's certain people who dress up like Thor and feel good, and or Spider-Man. But when you're dressing up like a Ghostbuster, they're not dressing up like Peter Venkman. They're dressing up like themselves that happens to be a Ghostbuster. They're like a part of the team. It's an organization that you can kind of improve yourself and make yourself feel better by being something greater than yourself, you know?
Yeah, no, that's why I said I really enjoyed it. And being a Back to the Future fan, you know, there are a lot of crossovers and similarities. And because I think Back to the Future is the greatest movie ever made. And I know people can disagree with it, but I think that, you know, top to bottom, you as a filmmaker, just give me this, and then we'll have to wrap this up. But what is your assessment of Back to the Future as a filmmaker?
Well, I mean, like, to me, like, I don't know, it's not on my top five, but it's my the best trilogy I think ever, you know, because of how interconnected it works. And I know there's a lot of like the Star Wars and the, you know, Lord of the Rings people, but like I think Back to the Future is the greatest trilogy because I love how it interconnects with the second movie and the third movie. They all kind of just make sense, and it's almost like a long, long story. Like if that would have been made now, it would just been like a, you know, some sort of TV series, you know, and it could have kept going on and on and on. I love it. I'm a fan.
All right. See, that's what I like to hear. That's why I knew Tommy Avalon was my guy. Ghostbusters fan, Bill Murray fan, Back to the Future fan, and of course a pro wrestling fan. Well,
I'll tell you my top five favorite movies.
I would like to hear that. What are they?
Yeah, it's unique, and I think you can tell a lot by someone's top five.
You can.
It's Ghostbusters. It's SLC Punk. It's Billy Madison. It's American Beauty. And sometimes I'll put Fight Club in there.
Okay, yeah. Interesting. That is an interesting. Yeah. It's a 80s and 90s heavy, but I like it. I can run with it. Billy Madison, one of the greatest comedies of all time, and it doesn't get its credit. I think Adam Sandler's work, you know, in the past 10, 15 years, I feel like is diminished in some people's eyes, not mine, but diminished those first two films because Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, I don't know. There's not a lot of movies that make me laugh that hard.
Yeah. Because it was fantastic. And real quick, so I did say sometimes Fight Club, and I'll interchange it with My Cousin Vinny if I have enough. I forget if I said that or not.
Yes.
But My Cousin Vinny is just the world to me.
I tried to convince my girlfriend to watch that for the first time the other day. She didn't want to do it. But I love My Cousin Vinny. Marissa Tomei, by the way, in that movie. I mean, come on now. Hall of Famer.
Yeah, well, just so many funny bits in that movie. But yeah, as far as Billy Madison, like, I mean, look, there's still, I mean, the Netflix special he just put out, the 100% Fresh, is phenomenal.
It's very funny.
That's early Sandler, really, you know? No, I think, like you said, like with any, yeah, I'm a fan. You know, there's some movies of his that I don't care for, but some I love, you know? Punch Drunk Love, even though, like, that wasn't, like, his, but he was in it, is phenomenal.
Yeah, great movie. Great movie. Man, I love My Cousin Vinny. You know what's funny? I wonder, so I'm from the South, so I love My Cousin Vinny because it made me laugh about some of the Southern, you know, colloquialisms and caricatures. And I'm guessing aren't you from New York, New Jersey area?
I'm like New Jersey, Philly.
New Jersey, Philly area. So, that's right. New Jersey, Philly area. So I'm sure you recognize people like Mr. Gambini, and as well as Ralph Macchio's character. That's funny. But that's a great movie. I love the top five. I love the Bill Murray stories, and I think you will too. Everybody, go check that out. And Tommy, let people know where they can find you, follow you, and follow some of your work.
Yeah, it's my name, Tommy, and then Avalone, A-V as in Victor, A-L-L-O-N-E, 3, at Instagram. And just Google me, you'll find it. You know, that's the way the world works, right?
That's the way the world works. Google him, he said. Tommy Avalone. Thank you so much, man.
I appreciate it.